I'm a big believer of just taking personal responsibility for your life to the extent that you can, because as you know, no one's going to do it for you. Like, your doctor's not going to fix your problems. That's not their job. I mean, their job is to keep you alive and to write prescription medications, to deal, to manage the symptoms of your problems. They would all love to make you better, but the system isn't set up for that. And so if you think that just going to your doctor is going to solve all of your health problems, it's probably not. It comes down to you. Like, you have to find the intrinsic motivation to make those changes. And you can't do that unless you have like a real purpose for living and like something you're trying to strive to achieve. So personal responsibility is really important, and changing your environment.
That was Aaron Stuber, and this is Follow Your Kind podcast with me, your host, Christina. So Aaron is a rock star. I first discovered Aaron through the podcast that he hosted together with Jackson Long called Thought for Food. Beyond just the podcast, Aaron and Jackson have built this beautiful online community fueled by plants, inspired by science, colored by humor, and free of judgment. Through this community, I have gotten to know them and many other cool people, many of who, including Aaron and Jackson, also supported my Team Humane campaign as I trained for my first marathon back in December last year, and it absolutely melted my heart. I know social media gets a lot of bad rap nowadays, but this was one of those cases where it helped spark connections with like-minded individuals for a greater good, and I'm very grateful for it. So their podcast is no longer live, as both Jackson and Aaron are working on bigger projects and are busy changing the world in other ways. But their legacy and our connection is still very much alive. I interviewed Jackson in February, it was episode 28, where he talked about endurance sport and plant-based diet. And now it's Aaron's turn. So Aaron is a nurse, a wellness coach. He's a board-certified lifestyle medicine practitioner. He's also a husband, a father of two beautiful little girls, an athlete, and just an incredibly funny, smart, and humble human on a mission to empower others through helping them realize the power of their lifestyle choices. In this conversation, we talk about Aaron's journey to discovering plant-based diet. He shares his experience of working in cardiac step-down unit. We talk about healthcare and how lifestyle medicine fits or should fit into the equation. And Aaron also shares some of the most common barriers to behavior change he has seen in his patients and how to overcome them. Please check out his website at aaronstuber.com, and I really hope you enjoy the show. Welcome everyone to another episode of Follow Your Kind episode and podcast, not episode.
Boom! Right out of the gate, she's making mistakes. Pressure's on. Think or swim.
Well, and that is Aaron Stuber. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hello. Hey, first question: can you hear that heater running in the background?
No. Wait, let me listen. No, I cannot. We're
it's like a buzzing. It's like a, okay. If you hear it, just tell me and I'm going to turn that sucker off.
Okay. I think we're good.
Right on. Hey, well, I'm excited to be here. Thank you for having me on.
This is amazing. Hi. Well, this has been a long time in planning, so I'm really excited to finally get to talk to you. And yes. Just right off the gate, I want to say thank you because your and Jackson's work on the podcast that you had got me through so many low plant-based days, and also just the way that you communicated and the way that how like easygoing and grounded you are was one of the inspirations to start my podcast. So thank you so much.
You're so very welcome. That was a real passion project for us, and I miss it every day, but we just got to the point where we just couldn't do it anymore, so it's the way it goes sometimes.
Yeah, well, you have a lot of exciting things on your plate going your way, so I'm excited to get into those. Cool. But so first of all, it is 7 a.m. Or 7:33 a.m. in the morning now in Boulder, Colorado. So what do plant-based dads do at 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning in Boulder, Colorado?
I podcast
with
with cool people like you.
Well, I get up usually much earlier than that. My youngest daughter, Stella, usually gets up around 6 or 6:30. So my wife and I take turns. You know, one morning it'll be my turn to get Stella up. The next morning it's hers. So we're usually up pretty early. Sometimes I try to get up at 5 to work out or, you know, just work on business related things, trying to grow various things. So I'm usually a pretty early riser. So right now I'm podcasting, but normally right now I would probably be thinking about maybe breaking my fast and eating breakfast and just hustling kids. I mean, that's like the life of a parent with 2 children and diapers. It's just children hustling constantly.
Yeah. How long is the fast?
So right now I'm trying to do, I do time restricted feeding, which is a form of intermittent fasting. And I'm trying to do 10 hour windows. So I'll usually eat at like 7 AM and then be done, have my last meal by 5. Mm-hmm. And so you eat within that 10 hour window. And so then I don't ever pay attention to the length of the fasting period, more the length of the period of time in which I can eat. Cause I think that's the more important part. But yeah, that's kind of something I'm always trying to do, is be better with my fasting stuff and time restricted eating. I think it's important.
That's really cool. I think, and I try to do the same thing, but I think I love your perspective for focusing on the frame of the time that you can eat versus the time that you cannot eat. Cause I also feel like it's probably mentally like switches your focus. It's almost like abundance versus scarcity, right? And you're like, oh, look at all of this food and all this time I can eat versus look at all of this time I have to deprive myself from.
Yeah. I don't know. That's so interesting. Cause maybe, so when I work with people, I usually am in focused on like, what foods can we add to your diet, as opposed to what's all the shit we're going to take away to make you feel awful. So maybe I like subconsciously, that's what I was doing. Sorry. Can I use profanity on your
Absolutely.
Podcast?
Absolutely. Please. I'm
not going to be really crude, because I got in trouble for that a lot on our podcast, but yeah, no, I think that's good. I think it's important to focus on the feeding window, as opposed to the fasting window. Cause most people like to think about everything in terms of the fasting period. They're like, well, I do 8 and 16. So, you know, I'm eating within an 8 hour window and I'm fasting for 16, but for some reason I don't calculate the back end. I just look at the front. Mm-hmm. And that just keeps me focused. I'm like, look, I have to be done at 5. Sometimes I'm not, and that's fine. I'm not militant about it, but yeah.
That's really cool. Really cool perspective. Okay. So, obviously we're all about plants, and there's like tons of other topics that I would love to pick your brain on, but let's talk about plants first. How did the plant-based nutrition and focus on plants came into your picture, and what was the triggering point?
Yeah, well, the first thing I learned were how dangerous lectins are. And so then once I knew about the lectins, I'm just not even going to go down that road. This stuff just bothers me so much. No, honestly, so God, this was probably 15 years ago. I was a climber, like a big climber at the time. And for me, it really started with, how can I get some sort of edge athletically from a recovery perspective on what I'm doing? And so I had always been sort of interested in high school with nutrition. I was really into weightlifting and just kind of like, I had like what I would consider like a pseudo interest in nutrition, because I didn't really understand it, but I thought I did. I was drinking like a couple gallons of milk a day, because that's what you do to build muscle, and making like triple stack cheeseburgers because that has protein in it and you got to get that for muscle. And so that was kind of my like initial interest in nutrition and in high school with weightlifting and stuff. And then became a big climber in college and was living in Oregon at the time. And just like, well, maybe there's something I'm not aware of and something I'm missing here. And so I just started reading books. I didn't know where to start. I was like, just kind of check this stuff out. I'd heard about vegetarians. I'd heard about veganism and stuff like that. And my honest opinion of that would be, super detrimental to athletic performance, but I didn't know. So I was like, well, let me just read a couple of books, and eventually got sort of interested in it and slowly started shifting to eating more plants, sort of less animal products. And then I think, if I remember correctly, I read The Food Revolution by John Robbins. And I was like, oh, and I expected it to just be kind of like a trashy book, but it was so well referenced. And I went and I looked at all of the studies and I was like, shit, this is pretty good. This is pretty good data. And so I was like, I'll just give it a try. And so I switched my girlfriend, who is now my wife. She was already vegetarian. And I was like, oh, I have some help already in the house, so I'll just switch over. And so I did, and we went vegetarian, and then I really quickly went totally plant-based. And you know, I'm not going to say that the dietary switch like gave me some enormous edge athletically. I felt like I recovered a little bit faster and had less soreness. You hear a lot of people in this space claiming that, like, well, if you just switch to a plant-based diet, you'll never get sore again. And you can do whatever you want. Like, you could run a marathon every day from the couch and you'd have no problems because you're on a plant-based diet. And antioxidants, they're gonna save everything, you know, cure everything. That wasn't the case for me, but I did feel good. What I was expecting was to feel terrible. And I actually felt really good. I had great energy. And I was like, oh, let's just keep doing this. Why not? I mean, it's got to be somewhat healthy. And then that just really triggered my own personal journey into wanting to understand more, like, what are the mechanisms here? Like, what are the things I should be understanding physiologically about what's going on? And just got really interested in it. And as you know, it's just sort of one iteration to the next. You learn a little bit more. That sort of piques your interest in other things. You start learning about the environment. That was cool. You start kind of delving into like the moral and ethical issues of eating animals. That's really, there's some really interesting philosophical arguments around that. Read some Peter Singer and some other stuff. So since that time, I've been on kind of various iterations, I guess, of a plant-based diet, from vegetarian to vegan to blue zones to Mediterranean, like low fat, high fat, low carb, high carb. I kind of have been all over the place and then really sort of settled on my best attempt at whole food plant-based. Mm-hmm. I eat more processed food sometimes than I should, but and I do actually occasionally eat honey, so I guess I'm not technically a vegan, but yeah, and that's kind of where I'm at now. I just eat plants and it's pretty awesome.
So what stands out for me is that you're going into expectation that the book is going to be shitty and then you still read it and then you read a book and then there's a bunch of studies and you're like actually looking at the studies and you're expecting to feel terrible on a plant-based diet, but you still go through it just to see how you feel. What's driving that?
A constant curiosity and a drive to experiment. I'm just like a laboratory experiment, basically, which I love. I just love, I think what you find that a lot in athletes. So athletes tend to be sort of type A people who like control over their environment. And I'm definitely that type of person. So I like to tweak stuff and mess with stuff and adjust levels and get my blood work done and kind of see what's going on. And that was just one way to do that. And if, as an athlete, if you can find any sort of edge to make you just a little bit better or a little bit stronger, you know, a little bit faster, you're gonna try it. And so I think that's what drives the curiosity is, I'm willing to suffer a little bit and sort of get over that hump to see if there's something exciting on the other end. And the same could be said with fasting. Like, fasting's kind of uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't want to be hungry. But I think it's important to be hungry sometimes. And so there's some discomfort there, but there's this like golden nugget at the end of that rainbow that I feel like if you can attain that, it's worth the initial struggle.
That's really cool. That's a really cool approach. And I appreciate also the fact that you do go through the trouble of experimenting on yourself and learning for yourself. I think it's so important to do for every one of us to like trust others and maybe look for guidance from others, but still yeah. exercise and try it on ourselves and see for ourselves what works and what doesn't work for our bodies.
That's all you can do. Honestly, that's really all you can do. You can understand the general principles, but to an extent, everyone is different and some people will respond differently to different stimuli. And so, yeah, you just have to try it yourself and see what happens. And that's fun. I mean, that's the funnest part of the game, I think, is just kind of seeing where you're at.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I want to get into the weeds a little bit on the plant-based nutrition and lifestyle medicine in healthcare setting, because I know you have a lot of experience working in the environment, especially from the clinical perspective. Mm-hmm. And this is also the area that I'm very interested in. So I'm looking forward to kind of getting your insight. I know you worked in cardiovascular setting, right, as yeah. a nurse. Talk to me a little bit about what it looked like for you, kind of what was your role, and then what were the things that you were seeing or not seeing that you wished to see in terms of lifestyle medicine and behavioral kind of support to the patients who are going through the treatments there.
Oh, geez. Where do I start? So right out of nursing school. So during nursing school, my true love was cardiac anatomy and physiology, cardiovascular pathophysiology. So anything and everything that could go wrong with your heart and your lungs and your blood vessels. And so I did my sort of nursing residency on a cardiac step-down unit. They call it cardiac intermediate care, or progressive care is the technical name for that. And so I was suited right out of graduation to work in that type of environment. So we moved to Boulder, and my first job out of school was on a cardiac step-down unit. So on a step-down unit, you are sort of a combination of a regular medical surgical floor and an intensive care unit. So you're right in between the two. So the acuity of your patients is pretty high, and the patient to nurse ratio is lower than you would have like on a standard floor. And it's usually all cardiac related stuff. So somebody comes to your floor, or would come to my floor, because they had just had a heart attack and they were in the emergency department, came in with chest pain. We took them to the cath lab. They had a stent. Now they're going to come up to our floor to recover. Maybe someone had a open heart surgery, like a CABG or a bypass mm-hmm. surgery. They spent a couple days in the ICU, and then they step down from the ICU to our floor to recover, and then eventually they go home. So I would see a little bit of everything related to cardiovascular stuff, but what you're really seeing, like the bedrock of disease on that type of floor, are all of the comorbidities that cause the cardiac problems. And we usually call that metabolic syndrome, metabolic syndrome is really the best term to use. So it's diabetes, obesity, high blood pressure. Which one am I forgetting here? So insulin resistance, which is the diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity, and high blood fats. That's the like sequela of pathologies that make metabolic syndrome. That's what I was dealing with primarily on the floor. All the cardiac problems, but then all the diabetes and all of the like downstream consequences of diabetes and high blood pressure and all of that stuff. So people were very, very sick and very unstable and very scared. And it was my job to keep those people alive.
No pressure.
So it was a stressful, yeah. So like not quite as crazy high pressure as the ICU, but sometimes you'd have patients that would get transferred to your floor and it'd be like, you should still be in the ICU. Like, this is insane. I mean, I'm titrating
a couple of really, really potent cardiac drips, you know, so like you're on IV medicine and you're getting this stuff and if I screw it up, you're going to die. And, you know, they're like all these infection protocols and all of this stuff for people who had just had open heart surgery. And it was just, it was intense. And really eye-opening from the perspective of chronic disease. It's just like, oh my God. I mean, I knew about it before that happened, but I didn't really understand how ugly it is and how like sad and scary it is for people. So that's what I did for 4 years on the cardiac floor. And I don't remember the last part of your question because I've just been sort of rambling, but like that was my experience on that floor. So what, where do you want me to segue on that one?
So yeah. So at that point that you're working on the floor, you're already right. You already have learned the benefits and the power of the plant-based nutrition and lifestyle change they can make. So how did you, of course, like I'm sure while running around and trying to keep people alive, there's not a whole lot of time you can like sit down and be like, let's watch Fork, Silver, Knives together or something. But how like were you, did you have an opportunity to kind of insert or like plant the seeds for the benefits and opening people's minds to this other component? And also, or maybe did you see, is there something in place like that for people who are in desperate need for a lifestyle change to have the resources enough to maybe do it at the moment or have something to follow up after they get out?
Yeah, so the hands down the most frustrating part of the job is, so like for example, you know, maybe someone had just come up their first heart attack and we got in there and I've looked at all of the radiology reports. They had an angiogram. I can see the coronary arteries that are occluded. One is maybe was 100% blocked. They put a stent in. They ballooned some other ones to open them up. And here this person is, fresh and scared in the room, and I am their nurse. And they're assigned what's called the cardiac menu. So this is, okay, you have cardiac disease, coronary artery disease. This is the menu that's appropriate for you. And on that menu, they can order meatloaf and Pepsi. I mean, it's not really, so the only difference between the regular menu and the cardiac menu is there's less salt, really. And like maybe a little bit less saturated fat, but not in any measurable way. And so they order, you know, a big tray of, you know, meatloaf and French fries and Pepsi. And that, of course, is frustrating. And of course, like the culture in the hospital is that that is totally appropriate and acceptable for them to be eating. So I always took it upon myself to sit down and just have open conversations with them about it. And I was never pushy. I was just would sort of ask like, hey, are you interested in has anyone talked to you since you got here about nutrition or lifestyle stuff that you could do to sort of manage this problem going forward? And the answer was always no. And so I would take as much time as I could out of my busy day to sort of talk about resources. So we might, I recommended Forks Over Knives all the time. Books, websites, you know, How Not to Die, nutritionfacts.org. Usually, like I had a pre-printed list that I would keep in my locker and I would just hand them the list. And then we would talk about that stuff. And most of the time, you know, I was always surprised by how interested people were in talking about it. And I think I was also very naive. So I assumed that because I had a sort of a captive audience and people were really interested in what I had to say, that that meant they were going to make they were going to go home and make all the changes and follow up with me. And it was going to be fantastic. And I found that like 95% of the time, even if I just gave them my email address and said, if you ever have a question about any of this, you can just email me. I'll call you. We can talk about it. I'd say 95% of the time I never heard from them again. And we would have these amazing, like come to Jesus moments in the room. Like you could have died. You're incredibly lucky. If you want to avoid death going forward, here's some evidence-based things that you can do. And they would cry and they would be so angry because no one had ever told them that. And like, why didn't my cardiologist talk to me about this? Like, et cetera, et cetera. But even that wasn't enough. And so I had this sort of wake up moment down the road where I was like, oh, well, what is the
what's the elephant in the room here? And the elephant is behavior change and the science behind behavior change, which I wasn't addressing. I was just kind of telling them what they needed to do. And that doesn't really work very well. And so that was a super frustrating experience for me.
I feel like, and tell me if you think I'm wrong, but I wouldn't say that like it wasn't enough. I think what you were doing is like arguably maybe one of the most important components, because you're planting the seed in the most fertile soil, right? So when the people just get out of what could have been their death, their moment of death, and then they get out and they live, and then they're fearful, but then they're also grateful and open to change. And then you introduce them to that and they're like, yes, let's do it. But I just think if that is the only thing that they get, it's just not going to grow, right? So I think what you were doing, I think it's beyond valuable. It's just, I wish there was a system or some kind of continuity or some kind of comprehensive approach. So people were getting support after they were like, okay, I'm down with it. Let's order a plant-based meal here at the hospital. Mm-hmm. And then assign me to a registered dietitian who can help me develop a meal plan. And then have a nurse call me a week later to ask me how I'm doing. And maybe give me some classes to attend so I can meet other people who are in the same situation, who are also struggling, and can talk to them. So I don't know. I don't want you to discredit what you were doing. I think it's important. I just think it sucks to be alone in this.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. So if you think of me as like planting the seed, but nobody watered it.
Exactly.
So it just didn't grow. And that's absolutely right. And I dream every day of a healthcare system where we actually have follow-up related to this stuff. And people try. We had a transitional care team at the hospital, and folks would call any patient that had a cardiac problem. They would call them, you know, a couple days after their discharge to check in with them. Hey, did you fill your prescription medications? Do you need any help with that? And it was usually around medication compliance, which is important, especially if you have heart failure, you know, something like that. Like, you've got to take your medications or you'll be right back in the hospital for management for that. But there wasn't really much of an emphasis on the lifestyle stuff. And that's a real problem. And that is sort of starting to change, but it's very slow change because there's no financial incentive to do it, which is a whole nother conversation on itself. So yeah, you're absolutely right. There just wasn't any follow-up. And I tried to follow up with them, and I often found that they just kind of pittered out after. Also normal. But yeah, I just wish we had a better structure in place. It would have been so helpful.
Yeah. Do you have any ideas or like any kind of proposals of like the formulas that you think would work?
So the biggest problem with our healthcare system from that perspective, there are many good things about our healthcare system and many bad things. The biggest problem that I see, or the biggest barrier to doing this properly, is that we currently exist in this fee-for-service model. So like someone comes into the hospital and the more tests a physician orders, the more the hospital gets reimbursed. So if you order that MRI, a CT scan, every new medication they get put on, that's all reimbursable money, especially from Medicare. And there's no incentive, especially in primary care, which is the perfect opportunity for healthcare providers to be talking to patients about lifestyle stuff if they have the time. There's no financial incentive for people to do that. They're already strapped for time. So the limited time that they already have, they have to follow a certain protocol to get reimbursed and to run a healthcare business. It's just the way it works. So there's a lot of talk about switching to an outcomes-based model where like a hospital will get reimbursed or a provider gets reimbursed based on the outcome of the patient. So if the patient does better, meaning like they don't come back into the hospital 2 weeks later, there's a payment there. And so people have been talking about that, but it's a really difficult thing to implement because the fee-for-service model is so ingrained and so entrenched at this point. It's just this behemoth project to tackle. And there are a lot of really, really smart people, people who are much smarter than me, who are absolutely struggling to figure this out. And part of the training in lifestyle medicine through the American College of Lifestyle Medicine was to learn a little bit about this stuff. And we would have, you know, I watched webinars where actuaries would come in and give their two cents on it. And people have been trying different models for outcomes-based care and seeing if it works. Some of the models work okay. Some of the models don't. It's really complicated. And that's the kind of thing, you know, so like for you, you're in grad school for public health. That's a realm of academia where people are working really hard to try to figure this stuff out. I don't have any great, I don't have any ideas that no one else has presented. And I don't think I have any tremendous insights on like the technicalities behind how we change that, other than I just know what a good system would probably look like. But that's like a lot of people do. I think a lot of people understand what would be ideal. The question is, how the hell do we get there? And I think we're slowly, incrementally moving ourselves there, but it's going to be very complicated. It's going to be very expensive. And fraught with problems.
Yeah.
So that sounds kind of gloomy, but it's just like just kind of the system we're in right now.
Well, I also want to just read really quick, because I think it the facts, the statistics from the website that you just launched, because I think it paints such an accurate picture. And again, not to make things gloomy, but just to kind of bring the message home and to communicate the importance of and the need for solutions for this, like, today. So if you go to Aaron's website, and I'll include the link in the show notes, some of the facts about the current situation that are presented there are 86% of annual healthcare spendings in the US is on preventable chronic disease. And it's incredible. Like the key word is preventable. So like we do not have to be spending that 86% of the just crazy amounts of dollars that we spend today, and that money can be used for something else. Then 70% of Americans are overweight or obese, with projections continuing to rise. So not only the situation is crazy already, but it's getting worse.
Yeah, it's getting worse. It's like slowing down a little bit, fortunately, but it's not going in the opposite direction, which is where we need it to go. We need it to be going down. At least it's not going up quite as fast, but it's still rising, and hopefully it'll peter out at some point. It's not good.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. And then the last fact is 130 plus million of Americans are affected by chronic disease, and nearly 40% of the population. And again, it's just crazy, because all of this, or most of this, is lifestyle imposed and lifestyle solvable.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, if you think about what's the biggest problem with healthcare, it's cost. It's totally unsustainable, and eventually the healthcare system will go bankrupt if we can't slow it down. And so, okay, what do you do? Well, you cut cost. Well, what the hell are we spending all of our money on every year? Well, almost 90% of that is on stuff we shouldn't be spending it on, chronic disease, which is preventable for the most part. That's not really a bad situation. And when I learned about that, it's such a mind-blowing thing. But it's also reflective of, if you work in healthcare at all, you see that every day. You're just like, wow, yeah, basically every single one of my patients has some chronic disease, and they're on some number of prescription medications to manage that. And they're in the hospital right now because of their chronic disease, some flare up or exacerbation. So that's an enormous problem. And so the best way to get the cost down is to address the disease with lifestyle stuff. But the elephant in the room there is, well, we have all these protocols and all this data, and we know that it works, but how do you actually get people to do it? And the way you get people to do it is to change their behavior, and behavior change is extraordinarily difficult for human beings. So that's the implementation problem. And that's why I think if you spend any
paying attention to this industry, there's been this enormous explosion in health coaching and behavior change science. And everyone is talking about behavior change now. And there's a reason for that, because we finally realize that we can have all the data in the world and we can have the best protocols in place, but if no one's going to do them at home in their busy lives, then it's all just a total waste of our time. So how do we get people to do it? It's you use some of the science of behavior change to get people to make sustainable, lasting change over time. And that affects the chronic disease rate, which then reduces our cost and maybe pulls us out of this like death spiral that we're in.
Yeah. So let's transition to the behavior change. And so I know you're also a certified health coach.
Not certified. I have formal health coach training, but I did not take the certificate. So I did the Well Coaches program in 2015. I got a scholarship from the hospital to do it. And I did the whole program and I didn't take the certification exam at the end, which I regret. So not certified, but I have at least some formal training in it.
Mm-hmm. And then you also got your certification, the board certification from the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. Mm-hmm. That is amazing. It's relatively recent, but my understanding is that the training and the preparation for it is just really, really robust, and they make you go through a lot of data and a lot of science.
Yeah. The board exam itself was pretty insane. That was intense. It was intense. Great training. I'm like so happy I did it.
So this is creating the new platform for you and a new springboard to maybe start or kind of transition your career a little bit in a different setting. So talk to me a little more about that. Maybe about, so you just launched your website, you're all looking to work with people individually and bring in that behavioral based component and to coach people and help people with adopting new positive lifestyle habits in order to arrest, reverse, or prevent chronic disease. Talk to me about that area of your career.
Yeah. So I've been working with people for a long time. So I did the health coaching stuff in 2015. And prior to that, when I was working on the cardiovascular floor, I had a private health coaching business where I was doing mostly nutrition consulting. And then Jackson and I had the podcast where we're talking mostly about nutrition. And I got to this place where I was like, you know, I think, so just focusing on the nutrition is really fun for me, but I'm missing these like really critical components. And we talked about exercise and stuff too, but I didn't really understand the data. And so then I discovered the field of this sort of burgeoning field of lifestyle medicine. And I was like, oh, that's perfect. Like finally someone focusing on the evidence-based components that are so important for just living a long, healthy life without any of the woo-woo stuff, which is a real problem for me. Because you have other models that are sort of similar to lifestyle medicine. You have like complementary and alternative medicine and integrative medicine. I was very involved in those things in nursing school, but there were components of it that I felt like didn't fit the evidence-based paradigm at all, like homeopathy or just kind of like crystal healing and just random shit like that. That just really bothers me. I'm like, well, hopefully someone will figure out a way to take all the stuff that really works and get rid of all the other stuff and just refine it and come up with a nice tight little package. And to me, that tight little package is lifestyle medicine. You know, it's sleep science, which we have robust data on. It's exercise, just like decades of data on that. Nutrition, all the best parts of nutrition, tobacco and alcohol cessation counseling, stress management, positive psychology. I mean, all of that stuff, those are the sort of the key components of lifestyle medicine, and that we have tons of data and they work really well and we have protocols in place. So I had this sort of aha moment where I'm like, okay, well, I have a clinical background. And so medicine is interesting to me, but I want to address a larger component of the things that are important to people. And so I decided to do the training and have kind of come back to individual coaching and consulting with businesses too. around like workplace wellness and employee health and stuff like that. And so, yeah, I launched the website. It's like the third website I've had now. But
Yeah, exactly.
So that's up. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm open to working with people individually or working with groups or working with businesses around this stuff. I have a lot of experience now in this field, and I'm just really looking forward to it. It's like by far the most valuable component of my job is just working with people one-on-one. I love doing it. And it's extraordinarily rewarding to see people sort of like have that light bulb moment and get it and then make sustainable change. So that's really enjoyable for me. So yeah, that's what I'm doing now among about a trillion other things.
So if you were to say like, who is your like perfect client or perfect patient, that would be going towards you?
Yeah. Well, I can work with anybody, but I mean, if I'm honest, the perfect patient is someone who shows up totally motivated and ready to change. And I think any person who works in this field would tell you the same thing. Like it's always great to work with someone who they email you and they're like, holy shit, you're my person. I'm ready. I've been thinking about this for a long time. And then you just kind of tell them what to do and they do it and they have amazing change and you feel really validated, and it's a big ego boost for the coach, right? That's not most people though. Most people are on some, so there's a spectrum. It's called the, now I'm going to forget about it, but I'll come around to it. But there's a spectrum of motivation in terms of behavior change. Mm-hmm. It's called the trans-theoretical model of behavior change. There's like pre-contemplation all the way up to like action and maintenance. And everyone is on some part in that continuum. And so a good coach is someone who can work with people no matter where they're at. And so I'm trying to be better about that. So yeah, I mean, anyone that is dealing with metabolic disease. So if you have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, maybe some sort of like pre-diabetes or diabetes, if you have weight that you want to lose, if you need help with nutrition at home, you have a busy lifestyle. I totally get busy lifestyles because I have one. That is sort of my ideal patient, is someone who has one or two or maybe three health concerns that they're dealing with, and they are sick and tired of being sick and tired and want to make change. But I'm open and available really to work with anybody. I don't have any like prerequisites for jumping on. Sometimes I'll refer people to psychiatric counseling if I feel like you'd just be better off doing some mental health work first, because that's not something that I'm equipped to do. And some people have such a complicated medical history and have so many comorbidities and are on so many medications that I think they should be working with a healthcare provider first to try to get some of that under control. And then we work together. It's just safer for them. Yeah, that's what I would say about that.
And then, so with your background and training with coaching and kind of behavioral change, what do you think are the most important components for people to move to that next stage? Either it is next stage of motivation or next stage of action. So let's say somebody's like, okay, I feel terrible. I don't feel good about my body. My blood pressure is too high, but at the same time, I'm not there yet to actually implement any kind of change. Like, how can you help people to think through that and reflect on that and be able to find motivation to actually put their frustrations into action?
Yeah, so it's a multifaceted process, and there are a couple of different ways to approach it. But I think most professional health coaching protocols would have you first establish what's called a wellness vision. So someone needs to figure out what the hell they want to do with their life and like why they get up every day. Why do you get out of bed? Like what's your motivation for continuing to live? And so you have them do, it's kind of like a perfect day exercise, which Jackson and I have talked about in the past. But you have them figure out like what are the most important things in their lives? What would an ideal life look like for them in terms of their health and their wellness? And then once they are very clear on that, it sort of gets the gears turning, like, okay, well, I know what I want, and I know now specifically what it would look like. So how do I get the motivation to like work myself up to that? And that's where goal setting comes in. So you walk someone up the trans-theoretical model of behavior change by setting what are called SMART goals. So specific, measurable, attainable, time-bound, I forget the R.
Realistic.
Realistic. So you set SMART goals. And the purpose of a SMART goal is, one of the big problems is that people set goals that are totally unrealistic and unattainable. They're just like, well, yeah, I'm going to lose 80 pounds in 2 months, you know, and then I'm going to be off all my medications and I'm going to run a marathon. It's like, have you ever done any of those things before? If the answer is no, then I would say it's very unrealistic and you're probably going to fail. And then you're going to feel miserable that you failed. So the purpose of the SMART goal is to get these little, tiny, actionable, achievable goals that you can set out over time. And as someone moves forward, learns the process of setting the goal, working towards the goal, attaining the goal, they build their self-efficacy. And so that is really the key, is like building self-efficacy so someone knows they can do it because they've been doing it. They've been setting goals and achieving them. And then that builds up their self-confidence to actually be a person who can make change. And that's how you start the fire, and that's how you work somebody up that model of behavior change, basically. And so your goal is to take someone all the way to the action phase where they're doing the thing. They bought the shoes and they've been training for their marathon and they're like in it. They're doing the action and then they run their marathon or they lose the weight or whatever. And then they hit maintenance phase where if you've really made long-term behavior change, they'll be in the maintenance phase where they're self-sufficient. They don't need you anymore. Maybe they have some relapses. That's also totally normal. But they're in that phase where this is long-term. It's now a part of their identity and just a part of their life, and they're never going back. So that's sort of in a nutshell, like what you want to do is like, why do you want to live? What are your goals? How do we set some small measurable things? How do we build your self-efficacy and then move you forward? That's the general principle for doing it. There's kind of some different opinions on that, but that seems to be the best evidence for moving people forward.
Mm-hmm. And I also love the idea of waking up and reflecting what it is that, like, why are you doing the things that you're doing? Because it's so important to take it down to the core. I'm curious, tell me more about the perfect day exercise. So it's like your vision, what are all the things that would make today great, or how does it work?
Yeah, so perfect day exercise is where you basically sit down and you take as much time as you need to write out in a very, very specific manner what your perfect day would look like. If you had no financial constraints, it's just whatever you envision your perfect life to look like, but in the snapshot of a day. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually a really fun exercise and it's very motivating. And it's something I do usually once a year, and it kind of changes over time, but now I've been doing it for so long that it's pretty much the same thing every year now. But yeah, you're just writing it out. So I'm trying to think of specifically like what mine is. Basically waking up at 5 a.m. and going out. So maybe I live on a farm and like I have this awesome house with some property, and I head out to my little like mother-in-law studio that I've converted into a gym. And I go out there and I crush a crazy workout and I feel amazing. And then I come back home and I make a big green smoothie. And then my wife and my kids wake up and we come downstairs and we all have breakfast together and we're happy. And then I just work. So I do remote work. Maybe I jump on a podcast with somebody. Maybe I'm working on some side hustles that I have going on. And I'm happy and I'm like doing meaningful things and I'm working with people and I'm helping people change their lives. and I feel rewarded. And that is basically my perfect day exercise. And I just do that every single day of the week. Like, that's what I would like to do. And so that's an example of something you can do. But yeah, just sit down and really think hard about what a perfect day for you would look like. And I think what happens when you do that is you start projecting what it is you really want. And that plants this seed of like, okay, well, there's the goal. Am I doing things in my life right now that are actually walking me towards that goal? Or am I going in the totally opposite direction? If you find that you're going in the opposite direction, you start to remove the barriers between you and that goal and start slowly riding the ship in that direction. And I think if you're really committed to that and serious about it, you may not attain specifically your perfect day, but you can get damn close if you're willing to work really, really hard. And I just think it's just like one of those life-changing things where, you know, it changes your mentality and it changes how hard you're willing to work for what you want.
I love it. What it makes me think of is that I think we almost like sensitized our dreams when we put them on this like pedestal thing that we think they're so far away and they're like, they're just dreams, right? But then we don't always think about like, okay, well, what is the gap between me and my dreams and how I can bridge the gap? And I have a friend who like told me years ago, do something every day that gets you closer to your dreams. Yeah. And I think it's like such a cool affirmation because it doesn't have to be hard. Like it doesn't have to be this huge milestone every single day. But as long as every day you take a little bit, at least a little step towards your dreams, just continue to go in that direction. Like it's going to be fine and it's going to work. And at some point you're going to be bridging that gap and that those dreams are going to become goals. They're going to become realities. And then at some point that you're going to be there.
Yeah. And if you're not there exactly, you're certainly going to be in a better place than you would have been if you hadn't been paying attention to it. I just think a lot of people live sort of unconsciously and they're not even considering what would be ideal for them based on where they are now. And they certainly aren't thinking specifically about goal setting and how they can get to that place. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is like the essence of what it means to live a good life. Is to live the examined life. That's what being examined means. You just are focused on it. Mm-hmm. And so I think if you can wake people up a little bit to be like, listen, you have many more options than you think, and you have more control over your destiny than you think. And if you, so like I check in with myself usually every night and I ask myself like, did I do at least one thing today to move, to right the ship and move myself in that direction? And usually the answer is yes. Sometimes it's no, and that's okay. Don't beat yourself up about it. Tomorrow's a new day and you can sort of focus on that. But once you get used to doing stuff like that, you never go back because you realize that the alternative to that is just living a life that you want nothing to do with. So that's my take on it.
Or like staying asleep almost.
Just kind of being asleep. And like a lot of people are sort of asleep at the wheel, I feel like, especially when you're dealing with a lot of medical problems that could be prevented. A lot of people don't know that they have issues that could be arrested or reversed with certain lifestyle changes. And that's the education component. But once you learn that, it's like, shit, I need to take control. I'm a big believer of just taking personal responsibility for your life to the extent that you can.
I'm with you.
And because as no one's going to do it for you. Like your doctor's not going to fix your problems. That's not their job. I mean, their job is to keep you alive and to write prescription medications, to manage the symptoms of your problems. They would all love to make you better, but the system isn't set up for that. And so if you think that just going to your doctor is going to solve all of your health problems, it's probably not. It comes down to you. Like you have to find the intrinsic motivation to make those changes and you can't do that unless you have like a real purpose for living and like something you're trying to strive to achieve. So personal responsibility is really important and changing your environment to the extent that you
can. And it's so empowering too. It's so empowering. Like some people may think it's scary, but it's not. It's empowering to do that.
Super empowering, especially when you start sort of like achieving the intermediate goals that are on the way to your big goal. You're like, holy shit, like I had three goals for this year, and one of them was to run a marathon or something. I just ran the damn marathon. Like, holy shit, I feel amazing now. Like, I ran a marathon. How crazy is that? Now I know I have this self-efficacy. I know I can set goals and achieve them and do really hard things. The rest of this stuff is nothing compared to like the suffering that I experienced for that. Marathons are sort of that like classic example of something that seems so impossible. And then you just work yourself incrementally. You just did this.
I know. I can so relate to it now.
Yeah. It's like you just, when you're at mile zero of your training, you're just like, there is no possible way I can run 26.2 miles. Mm-hmm. My legs will break. Like I'll die. Something terrible is going to happen. And then you work yourself up slowly. You do those incremental changes. And then eventually you cross the finish line and you're like, oh, I get it. So this is life. Like, this is the process of living life. Incremental changes, and then eventually you're just there at your goal.
Oh, I love it. You're amazing. Okay, I know we have a few more minutes, but I want to talk a little bit about your kind of transition back into your personal life. So I know you have two beautiful girls, and I'm a wonderful life. So I'm curious about how do you balance all of the things that you do, and then with being grounded, with being a father and spending time with your kids, raising your kids on a plant-based diet, and then also like incorporating, I don't know, the active lifestyle and all the cool stuff that you do. How do you manage that?
Honestly, I have no idea. I think I'm just very clear in like what the purpose of my life is, and that sort of drives me forward. Like I am willing to suffer a little bit more than I think most people are. And I'm also very good with time management and sort of mapping my day out. And sometimes I just fail miserably with this, honestly, and I feel super lazy. But for the most part, I'm very focused on like what the day is going to look like and what time I'm going to do things. And it's very structured. And I'm just motivated. Like it's part of my identity to be someone who is an athlete, to be someone who is fit. And it's part of my identity to be someone who works hard on the things that are important to them. And as long as that remains part of my identity, I'm going to continue to do it no matter how many things are sort of stacked on top of me. It's really difficult. I mean, they say having kids is the hardest thing you'll ever do in your life. That is like understatement of the year. I mean, I honestly had no idea. I just kind of assumed I think it's going to be kind of challenging. It is just extraordinarily soul crushing and difficult every day and amazing at the same time. It's like kids are the sort of double-edged sword. It's like they just kill you and you love them so much and they bring you so much joy. So I think, honestly, to be specific, a lot of it comes down to time management and knowing what is absolutely essential, an essential component of your day. So for me, that's finding time to exercise and get in whatever it is that feels important to me, whether that's functional strength training or doing some endurance training or going on a hike or like working out in the living room with my wife, something like that. And then just having some sort of core values about what kind of parent you want to be and the kind of work that you want to do. Do you want to be of service to the world in some way? So that is why I work hard and sort of how I manage everything is like I'm very clear on my core values and what I want out of life. And if I get knocked down, I just get back up again and just slog on. Getting along at this path for a long time now, and I'm not anywhere close to my goals, but I just keep working at it.
That's amazing. Okay, I have one more question that I usually close the podcast with, but I want to see if there's anything else that we haven't mentioned that you wanted to make sure that we talk about before I ask the last question.
No, not really. We have such a problem in the West with chronic disease, and it's bankrupting us, and I am really passionate about finding solutions to that problem. And to the extent that we can get more people talking about this and like getting lifestyle medicine training and doing like what you're doing, getting a master's degree in public health and trying to find solutions to this stuff, that is incrementally making the world a better place. And so it's just a topic that I think is endlessly fascinating that I love talking about, but I can't think of anything else I would want to cover. I mean, we could talk about this for 6 hours if you want to, if I had time, but
I mean,
I think we hit all the questions. Yeah, exactly. I think we hit all the salient points.
I know. I'd love to have you again because I think I have like 1,000 other topics that I would love to explore with you more.
Yeah, so anytime.
Do it. Okay. So I usually, the name of the podcast is Follow Your Kind, as you probably know. And I always, my motivation for it is helping other, or I'm curious to explore the meaning of kindness for other people so that people who may necessarily have thought about it before can kind of like use it as an example and be more conscious in their actions and follow mm-hmm. their definition of kindness. So what does kindness mean to you, and how do you get to follow it in your daily life?
God. Honestly, I think kindness starts with my kids. Mm. So one of the things that will happen to you when you become a parent is you'll be so drained of energy and so tired and just at your wit's end, and your kids know all the ways to just turn your buttons, and you will have to wrestle with this constant duality between like, how am I just being a great parent who's like kind and loving to my children and not tearing their heads off at the same time, because you've just run out. Like, you've run out of steam. You're fed up. It's the end of the night. They are screaming. They ask you to make dinner. You make spaghetti for them. And then they say, I don't want spaghetti. You know, it's like something like that. And you totally lose your shit. So I think kindness for me starts with my kids and sort of that daily reminder of like, they're just kids. They're 2 and 4 years old. They have no idea what they're doing in the world. They don't think properly. Their prefrontal cortex hasn't even begun to develop. Like, they don't think rationally. What are you going to do to get your shit together to remain like a stable, compassionate, kind parent who can also like talk about discipline a little bit and build rules and sort of rules and protocols for how to just be a good person. Mm-hmm. So that's where it starts. And then I think as human beings, we have this really unique opportunity to extend compassion to not just other humans, but animals, because we have a choice. Like, we're at the top. We're at the very top of the food chain. We have control. We have mastered and controlled almost every aspect of our environment. And the things that live below us, like, we have control now. Like, we don't have to eat animals if we don't want to. And I think that's one way, just in your dietary choices, to extend kindness and compassion to things that don't have a choice and don't have a say, I think, in what's going on now that we're running the show. And it's up to us whether we want the planet to explode or whether we kill ourselves in a nuclear holocaust. Like, we run everything now and we have the choice. And so, just sort of reflective of your podcast as well and your personal values, I think that's an obvious thing that I do to try to be more kind and more compassionate, is just mm-hmm. start with my kids and extend that to animals to the extent that I can. That's what I, yeah. There are more ways I think you can use kindness, but that's, for me, those are the two most salient ways that I do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for all you do. Thank you for the time this morning. I know I'm going over just a little bit, but I really, really appreciate it. We're going to have you back to the show for sure.
Have me back. It's been a pleasure to be on, and thank you for your time.
Yeah.